You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. There have been some 210 American troops killed in the Iraq War, with slightly more than two-thirds the targets of hostile fire. The rest died in accidents or so-called friendly fire incidents. According to CNN, of the total killed, some 81 have died since May 1st, when President Bush stood on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln and announced the official end of the military phase of the war. One of the strongest arguments for supporting the war was the assertion by the Bush administration that Iraq was attempting to reconstitute its nuclear weapons program. Having retracted statements made in the State of the Union address, Bush has come under fire from political pundits and intelligence experts alike. Jay Bookman, the deputy editorial page editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, wonders if one war fact on Iraq is false, what of the others?
A State of the Union address is a solemn rite, an opportunity for our nation's president to speak directly to the assembled members of Congress and to his fellow citizens. The occasion takes on a still heavier burden when a president uses the speech to press for war against another nation. But this year, when President Bush used his State of the Union address to make his case for war on Iraq, a central claim in his argument was false, and he had every reason to know it was false. Contrary to what the president told the American people, the Iraqi government had not recently attempted to acquire uranium from Africa. That false assertion was fundamental to backing the president's larger claim that Iraq posed a nuclear threat to the United States, which we now know it did not. The question then arises, did President Bush make an honest mistake? Or did he and his administration intentionally deceive the American people, in effect leading us into war under false pretenses? The evidence so far suggests, but does not prove, that some officials, perhaps officials high in the administration, knew the report was false, but allowed it to be included in the speech anyway. We do know that the president based his claim on documents that were forged. At first glance, that might seem reassuring. After all, even the most sophisticated intelligence agencies can conceivably be fooled by a sufficiently clever forgery. Unfortunately, all parties in this case concede that the forgeries were crude and easily exposed. For example, after investigating for less than 2 days, UN officials were able to state unequivocally that the documents had been fraudulent. By the time the president made his speech in January, the CIA had possessed those same documents for more than a year. By then, the CIA had already forced the White House to strip the claim out of an earlier speech back in October because it could not be substantiated. Furthermore, 11 months before the president's speech, U.S. officials had dispatched a retired ambassador to Niger to investigate the documents. That official, Joseph Wilson, quickly and easily determined that they were not valid, and he reported that finding to the CIA. According to Wilson, his mission had been instigated by questions from the office of Vice President Dick Cheney, and the results would have been reported back to that office. According to Wilson, quote, "The office of the Vice President, I am absolutely convinced, received a very specific response to the question it asked, and that response was based upon my trip out there," unquote. The Bush administration's subsequent handling of the issue has served to compound suspicion. It has tried to defend the president's statement by suggesting that it was also backed by some unspecified evidence in addition to the forgeries, but that evidence is not forthcoming. While conceding that the claim should not have been included in the president's speech, it has also claimed that the statement was technically correct. And technically, it was. In his speech, the president did attribute the claim to British intelligence, because his own intelligence agencies were telling him it was false. Knowing all that we know now, the reference to Iraq's attempt to acquire uranium from Africa should not have been included in the State of the Union speech, an unidentified senior Bush official conceded last week. But that's just the point. What they know now, many of them also knew back in January, when a false claim was foisted on the American people. Wilson, the retired diplomat selected by the administration to go to Niger to investigate the issue, is now deeply troubled by how the report is being handled. It really comes down to the administration misrepresenting the facts on an issue that was a fundamental justification for going to war, Wilson notes. It begs the question, what else are they lying about?
Jay Bookman is the deputy editorial page editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The White House's acknowledgement last week that Bush made inaccurate claims about Iraqi attempts to obtain uranium from Africa came in response to a similar brewing controversy in the UK. Last week, the Foreign Affairs Committee of the British Parliament released a report questioning the reliability of British intelligence about Saddam Hussein's efforts to obtain weapons of mass destruction in the run-up to the war in Iraq. An intelligence consultant confirmed that Bush was told the intelligence was questionable, but he chose to use it anyway. Sonali Kolhatkar of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles spoke recently with Rania Masri, an Arab-American anti-war activist with the Institute for Southern Studies and the director of the Southern Peace Research and Education Center. In the first part of their discussion, which aired Friday on Peace Watch, Masri gave an in-depth analysis of the current situation on the ground in Iraq. In this conclusion, she responds to the question of why the Iraqi people have not welcomed U.S. occupation of Iraq, given the brutality of the Saddam Hussein regime.
Well, if the U.S. troops had gone in and committed the massacres that they had, and we need to recognize that there were massacres committed in this phase three of the war, this bombing and invasion of Iraq, but if they had done that and then left and returned to their bases in North Carolina and elsewhere in the United States, then perhaps we may say, yes, the Iraqis right now can try to rebuild their country and try to claim the vestiges of what is remaining from their country after decades of U.S. and British involvement and decades of U.S. support to the Saddam Hussein regime. Perhaps. But now, after they have done all these killings, we have the occupation remaining. So this idea of comparing one dictatorship to an occupation, trying to figure out which is the lesser of two evils, remains at the end of the day with an evil. And it remains a discussion that we as human rights activists need to, you know, confront uphand and reject flat out. We should not be in a position to simply accept the situation because it potentially may be less destructive than the situation that they were in previously, which is false because I believe that this situation is actually more destructive than the Saddam Hussein regime because it is working for privatization in Iraq, because it is working for the selling off of Iraqi resources, the selling off, again, this is not only of oil, but also of the water system in Iraq, the selling off of Iraqi companies, the breaking down of those companies, the opening up of trade barriers in Iraq so that Turkish companies, Israeli companies, U.S. companies, European companies can go in and flood the markets. And therefore, even though the Iraqi companies that are, in the true sense of the word, private entrepreneurs, would not be able to withstand this competition. So what we would be having is a dramatic increase in poverty. We already know that the sanctions on Iraq have resulted in one out of five Iraqis in central and southern Iraq being under the poverty line. This is according to the World Food Program. And we are expecting that poverty to increase. So we cannot in any way, shape, or form say, well, you know, they had Saddam Hussein and now they have the U.S. occupiers and that's better. No, they're both wrong. And actually, this situation right now, I believe, very much is more destructive than it was previously.
Finally, one last question, Rania, with respect to the Iraqi resistance itself. What have you been reading about, or what do you know about how Iraqis are resisting this occupation? What are the acts that they're taking? And at some level, what is the importance of the people who were in the anti-war movement leading up to the war? What is our responsibility right now toward Iraq?
Well, a few things, because those are really big questions. I heard one American general refer to the Iraqi resistance as thuggery. And I would not claim it as thuggery. I would claim it as grassroots resistance. Perhaps it is nationally organized. Perhaps it is locally organized. One can only hypothesize. But what is really clear is that it is coming from the people. Nobody is pushing them to commit these acts of resistance. And they are anywhere from face-to-face shooting to attacking the U.S. tanks to attacking U.S. soldiers to protecting their own homes. There's a whole range of resistance that is going on. And this resistance is increasing. We have had, since May 1st, the day that George Bush declared the end of so-called military hostilities in Iraq, we have had approximately 60 U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq during this post-war stage, which leads us to what should be our position as anti-war activists and what should be our position as people who believe that all human life is sacred. We recognize that the vast majority of people in the U.S. Army are people who have been drafted economically into the U.S. Army. They are not people who chose to join the Army in order to support Bechtel and Halliburton and Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and Boeing. There are people who joined because they wanted an education, wanted a job. And I believe it is our responsibility to work with military families, speak out, other veterans organizations to demand unequivocally that these troops come home, that they need to come home. That is the greatest act of support we can give for the troops. And it's the greatest act of support also, I believe, that we can give for Iraq as well as for Iran, which is next in line in this war against terrorism. That is point one. Point two, with regards to the greater picture, we need to recognize that Iraq is not being looked at in separation. Iraq is part of the whole Arab problem to link what is happening in the occupied Palestinian territories. And we need to recognize how the occupation in both levels and the corporatization of both situations is very similar to what is happening here at home with our continuing deprivation of civil rights, the continuing move to privatize everything in this country, from the public school systems to the prison systems, and the way that is affecting our community, and the continuing loss of democracy that we are facing in this country. So we need to be doing exactly what the administration is trying so hard not to do, which is link issues. Link all these issues and recognize how we are all victims of the same policy and how together, joining our forces, we can actually overcome this destructive system.
Rania Masri is an Arab-American anti-war activist with the Institute for Southern Studies and the director of the Southern Peace Research and Education Center. She was interviewed by Sonali Kolhatkar of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. Well, as the storm of controversy continues to plague the Bush White House, one of the top whistleblowers in the administration is former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who served as acting ambassador to Iraq during the Gulf War. Wilson is a lifelong diplomat who served in several African countries during his career. In a speech on June 14th at the Education for Peace in Iraq Center, Wilson spoke of himself anonymously in the third person. Recently, he revealed that he was indeed the ambassador who went to Africa at the behest of the Bush administration to investigate the validity of assertions regarding Iraq reconstituting its nuclear program. Those claims, he discovered at the time, were false, but the administration chose to include them anyway.
To those of you who are going out and lobbying tomorrow, I just want to assure you that that American ambassador who has been cited in reports in the New York Times and in the Washington Post and now in the Guardian over in London, who actually went over to Niger on behalf of the government, not of the CIA, but of the government, and came back in February of 2002 and told the government that there was nothing to this story, later called the government after the British white paper was published and said, you all need to do some fact-checking and make sure the Brits aren't using bad information in the publication of a white paper, and who called both the CIA and the State Department after the President's State of the Union and said to them, you need to worry about the political manipulation of intelligence if, in fact, the President is talking about Niger when he mentions Africa. That person was told by the State Department that, well, you know, there's four countries that export uranium. That person had served in three of those countries, so he knew a little bit about what he was talking about when he said, you really need to worry about this. But I can assure you that that retired American ambassador to Africa, as Nick Kristof called him in his article, is also pissed off and has every intention of ensuring that that this story has legs, and I think it does have legs. It may not have legs over the next 2 or 3 months, but when you see American casualties moving from 1 to 5 or to 10 per day, and you see Tony Blair's government fall because in the UK it is a big story, there will be some ramifications, I think, here in the United States. So I hope that you will do everything you can to keep the pressure on, because it is absolutely bogus for us to have gone to war the way we did. As I used to say when I was doing my interviews before the war, the issue of weapons of mass destruction is primordial. It is important. It was absolutely vital that we correct the policing operation associated with Resolution 687, which was a resolution that said, thou, Saddam, shall not have weapons of mass destruction. That was the peace that was broken. Correcting that, which we did essentially by 1441, was the right thing to do. Going from 1441 to an invasion, conquest, and occupation war was not the right thing to do. I am struck also by some of the numbers that, that keep turning around in my head as I look at this. The president said, I've got four reasons for going to war in Iraq. One, weapons of mass destruction, which was handled by 1441 unanimously, but that wasn't going to get him to war so long as you had an inspection process in place. So two, terrorism. We wanted to stamp out terrorism. This was part of our war on terrorism. Now, here in the United States on September 11th, 2001, we suffered the loss of two buildings in New York and severe damage to one building in Washington, and we suffered the loss of roughly 3,000 lives. In Iraq, during the shock and awe bombing campaign, we now know that over 3,000 Iraqis were killed. We ought to assume that the better part of Baghdad currently suffers from post-traumatic shock syndrome, among all the, in addition to everything else they suffer from. And Lord knows how many buildings in downtown Baghdad and elsewhere in the country were destroyed. And it was one thing to watch the war on Fox News, CNN, and ABC, where everybody tried to put a bigger American flag on their TV station than the next person. It was quite another thing to watch the war through the lens of Al Jazeera or any of the other Arabic newspapers, where every child who was killed or maimed, or every building that was hit, or Baghdad in flames by night, resonated in a far different way than it resonated in the United States. Now, in our war on terrorism, how can we possibly assume that the anger that we felt when 3,000 of our fellow citizens were killed is not going to be felt in spades, not just in Iraq, where 3,000 deaths represents, by relative to the total population, 10 times the number of deaths that we suffered in our terrorist attack, or throughout the rest of the world. So if, in fact, you buy into the idea that this was part of our war on terrorism, guess what? We have created, and the polls show this, an entire generation of Arab who essentially is going to hate the United States and Americans. And if they remain disaffected, they are a wonderful recruiting tool for al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda-like organizations going forward. Of course, we didn't find any terrorists when we got to Iraq, just as we haven't yet found any weapons of mass destruction, though on that score, I remain of the view that we will find biological and chemical weapons, and we may well find something that indicates that Saddam's regime maintained an interest in nuclear weapons. Not surprising if you live in a part of the world where you do have a nuclear-armed country, enemy of yours, that is just a country away from you. The third reason, of course, the president mentioned was the transfer of weapons of mass destruction from a rogue nation and a rogue government to international terrorists. George Tenet testified up on the Hill, and his testimony was, and I wrote something similar in an article I wrote for the San Jose Mercury News, he testified that, yeah, it was entirely possible that Saddam would transfer weapons of mass destruction to international terrorists, but only in extremis. That essentially, if you are an autocratic thug, which Saddam is and was, certainly was, he's still a thug, even if he no longer has the totalitarian powers that he once had, you're not going to give up control of something to a group that you don't have any control over. It just doesn't make any sense, particularly given the fact that Saddam, who is not a dumb man, he is a sociopath, and he's a killer, but he is not dumb. He knew and has known for years that any time anything happens to American interests, the first place we look is at Iraq. On September 10th, Saddam was riding high. There was absolutely no reason for him to be involved in September 11th. He had essentially worked his way pretty much back into the Arab League. The sanctions regime had been eased so that he could get more of the stuff that he needed, both to enrich himself and to keep his country at bay, his population at bay. There was absolutely no reason for him to have been involved in September 11th, and indeed, it's clear that that he wasn't, even though by the time we went to war, a majority of the population thought that it was Iraqis who had been involved in September 11th. The fourth reason And oh, by the way, if you buy into the transfer theory, well, guess what? That transfer has probably occurred. You've heard recently reports to the effect that we did not secure the nuclear site, for example, until after it had been thoroughly looted. Lord knows how many other high-priority weapons of mass destruction sites were not secured. If ever there was an indication that this was not a weapons of mass destruction war, it ought to be in the sloppiness of the battle plan that did not have us securing these sites from the first day. Now, the fourth reason that the president gave was the liberation of the Iraqi people, which is indeed a noble cause. And everybody who has ever been to Iraq or knows anything about the Ba'athi regime in Saddam Hussein knows that it is one of the two, or was one of the two, most oppressive and most dangerous and most belligerent regimes towards its own people in the world. The question really comes down to whether or not it is the job of American soldiers to go over and liberate Iraqi people. And the argument that I would make is that every time we have had this debate, and it happens every 4 year when we do the quadrennial review, we conclude that it is the role of the American military to defend the national security of the United States. We have other organizations and we have other tools. We won the Cold War. We liberated Eastern and Central Europe without killing Romanians, Bulgarians, Poles, Czechs, Slavs. It takes a little more patience. It takes a little more creativity. People in the intelligence community, people in the diplomatic community, people in the economic sanctions community, people in the political community have to work a lot harder. It doesn't show up on your television screens as shock and awe, the burning of Baghdad at night or the firebombing of Dresden, but it yields results. But this administration could not be patient. The other figure, of course, that strikes me is we've got about 180 Americans dead, another 40 or 50 Allied troops dead. That is roughly four times the amount of Iraqis from the diaspora who actually showed up when the Pentagon said it was going to raise an Iraqi liberation force. Now, I don't know how hard the Pentagon went out and recruited Iraqis from the diaspora of roughly 4 million. And I don't really know how many Iraqis were of that fighting age. But I do know, and as you see on the streets of Tehran today, that in order to have a liberation strategy, you have to have people who are willing to fight for their own liberation. Otherwise, you will never get that liberation bounce that Ken Edelman promised us, then Richard Pearl promises, when they said that the Iraqis would be cheering from the rooftops at our marching in there. And I have always said that no matter how much the Iraqis hated Saddam Hussein, we ought not to assume that that was automatically going to transfer for love and affection for the Americans. Because first and foremost, Iraqis are an extraordinarily proud people. They have a long and distinguished history. More of them remember the exploits of Saladin and Nebuchadnezzar than Americans remember Washington, Lincoln, or Al Gore. I mention Al Gore because it's more recent. They know what it's like to be conquered. They were under the Ottomans for several hundred years. They know what it's like to be conquerors. They don't like being conquered. They particularly don't like being conquered, or one should have assumed from the very beginning that they were not going to like being conquered, by a couple of countries that have been in forefront of maintaining economic sanctions on the population for 12 long years, which economic sanctions devastated the middle class, the glue that holds the society together. This is a proud people that we had already brought to its knees over 12 years. We could have done this much differently. Now, there were three or four different foreign policy agendas at play here. Only one, which was true. There was the weapons of mass destruction agenda, which was handled by 1441. There was the terrorism agenda, which was handled by Afghanistan. As Ted Koppel, when Carl Levin and I debated Jim Woolsey and John McCain on Nightline, Ted Koppel started the evening by saying there's an old Arab saying, I think actually it's a Chinese saying, but he said it was an Arab saying, that says sometimes to get the monkey's attention, you got to kill the chicken. Well, we did that. We did that in Afghanistan. And if, in fact, the monkeys that we were trying, whose attention we were trying to get, with the other two countries of the Axis of Evil, North Korea and Iran, let me suggest to you that there were two lessons that they took away from it. One was, we better get nuked up real quick so that if these guys decide to come after us, we have our deterrence in place. And two was, they're not going to come after us. We're too strong. They went after the weak sister. They went after the country whose army they had already defeated 12 years ago, whose army they had kept under economic sanctions, whose population they'd kept under economic sanctions for 12 years, and whose anti-aircraft and other defenses they had run a several-month-long campaign to deteriorate and degrade before they ran the march to Baghdad. Which, by the way, as valiant as our soldiers was, this was not the liberation of Paris. The only thing that slowed down our juggernaut getting into Baghdad was the speed limit signs on the highways going up there. And I mean no disrespect to our military in this. We run military campaigns very well. But we were not running a military campaign against the elite of the elites. As somebody said, this was like the New York Yankees playing Podunk High. Even some of our military officers were absolutely dismayed at the slaughter they were inflicting upon poorly trained, poorly equipped Iraqi conscripts on the way up there. All this will come back to haunt us. The real agenda in all of this, of course, was to redraw the political map of the Middle East. Now, that is code, whether you like it or not, for putting into place the strategy memorandum that was done by Richard Perle and his study group in the mid-90s, which was called A Clean Break, A New Strategy for the Realm. And what it is, cut to the quick, is if you take out some of these governments that are antagonistic to Israel, then you provide the Israeli government with greater wherewithal to impose its terms and conditions upon the Palestinian people, whatever those terms and conditions might be. In other words, the road to peace in the Middle East goes through Baghdad and Damascus, maybe Tehran, and maybe Cairo, and maybe Tripoli if these guys actually have their way.
Former Ambassador to Iraq Joseph Wilson speaking at the Education for Peace in Iraq Center. Thanks to Democracy Now! For that segment. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. And our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA, Ron Pinchback, Benta Berkland, Trevor Fitzgibbon, and Harmony Rising. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.